This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Jetzt gibt's Cheez-It, ein neuer knuspriger Snack, der köstlich nach Käse schmeckt. Hol dir jetzt deine Packung im Handel und das Beste, du kannst sie einmal gratis testen. Wer will heute Abend den Cheez-It? Cheez-It, der Cheez-It. Jetzt zum Gratis-Testen. Teilnahme ab 18 Jahren. Kauf- und Kassenbon-Upload bis 30. Juni erforderlich. Nur solange der Vorrat reicht. Teilnahmebedingungen auf Aktionspackungen und auf cheezit-aktion.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the think spot in the metaverse, where in 28 minutes you and I get to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject. This week, the world has taken its eyes off Afghanistan. But what has been happening there since the Taliban returned to power? And what does it mean for the rest of us? It's just over a year since the Taliban launched an offensive in Afghanistan that, within a matter of weeks, succeeded beyond the West's wildest nightmares. On August the 15th, Kabul fell, and life changed dramatically for the Afghan people. Since then, they've faced shortages of food, a failing economy, and a bombing campaign launched by Afghanistan's own ISIS, ISIS-K. So is it Taliban 2.0, as some people hoped? How is the Taliban dealing with its domestic challenges? And how is it managing its relationships with its neighbours and countries further afield? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Let's start with what's happening on the ground. The briefing room's Ben Carter spoke with Sukunda Kamani, the BBC's Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent.
Sukunda, we spoke to you just before Christmas. What changes have you seen in Afghanistan in the last 6 months?
Well, look, the economic crisis, which is provoking a humanitarian crisis, that's still very much ongoing. The situation has slightly improved, but only ever so slightly. I mean, we're talking about 19 million people who are facing acute levels of food insecurity compared to previously more than 20 million people. But those improvements are driven really by the fact there's been a large amount of humanitarian aid and because of seasonal changes. The harvest is coming up. So still real concern about the struggle for so many people just to put enough food on the table for their family. So many families unable to do that. But I think what really stands out over the last 6 months is the hardening of the Taliban's attitude to governance. We've seen them detain and allegedly torture at times female protesters, for example. We've also seen intensifying crackdown on women's rights. So we've seen the Ministry for the Promotion of Virtue and Prevention of Vice come to the forefront and order women to wear face veils. We've seen girls' secondary schools remain closed. Many expected them to reopen back in March. On the very day they were due to reopen, though, the Taliban leadership announced that they would be closing down. And that really provoked a kind of outpouring of national grief. So bad news, really, over the last 6 months, particularly for those watching Afghans' women's rights.
I read an ex-chief Taliban negotiator recently gave a speech where he expressed frustration at what he perceived to be narrow-minded Taliban policies with regards to women. And that speech was promoted by quite a few influential Taliban accounts. Is the Taliban split on certain policies?
Well, look, certainly particularly on this issue of female education, on girls' schools reopening, in the vast majority of the country, teenage girls are still not allowed to go to school. The Taliban insist publicly that they're trying to create the right Islamic environment to allow them to do so. But, you know, after that chaotic last minute U-turn back in March, many people in the country are deeply skeptical of that. And yes, there is frustration within the Taliban over this too. And you know, one Taliban official even described to me the silent majority of Taliban figures being in favour of girls' schools reopening. Another told me that even amongst the Taliban's government's cabinet, all the ministers were in favour of girls' schools reopening, but a handful of highly influential religious and clerical figures close to the supreme leader in Kandahar, they're the ones who are most reluctant to allow there to be any progress. The supreme leader's word is in many ways final, and if he has doubts about it, if he's opposed to female education, then we may not see any progress on it anytime soon. But it certainly is an interesting one to watch how these divisions and debates within the Taliban develop up until now, the Taliban has been very good at keeping a lid on the sign of any kind of internal dissent.
And if we look at the economic situation, reports of central banking paralysis, is there any sign that the economic situation is improving?
Not really, no. I mean, you've got Afghanistan's foreign reserves have been frozen. It was a very aid-dependent country. 75% of public spending came from foreign grants. And those wider development grants have largely been cut off since the Taliban takeover. Humanitarian aid is still going in, although, of course, there are concerns about whether that will be enough. Many observers say it simply won't be. I think, according to the World Bank, around a third of per capita income had been slashed by the end of last year. That's likely to be even worse by now, I think. Many people, if they're still getting salaries in government jobs, have seen their salaries reduced. I was going to a couple of more upmarket Kabul restaurants recently, and there were people there. So it's not as if everyone is starving. But I asked some colleagues who I was with, who are these people who are eating at these restaurants? How are people affording it these days? And they said, look, the only people who are eating in these restaurants these days are members of the Taliban and smugglers.
There's been a spate of bombings in recent months carried out by an ISIS affiliate called ISIS in Khorasan province, or ISK. How big a risk do ISK pose to stability in Afghanistan and the neighbouring region?
Yeah, ISK is extremely brutal. I mean, they've been behind some of the most horrific acts of violence that we've seen over the past 20 years, often targeting Afghanistan's Hazara Shia minority. They've attacked them in mosques, in sports clubs, in maternity hospitals, tuition centres. It's really been relentless. And they, in fact, accuse the Taliban of being too moderate, while the Taliban accuse ISK being too extreme. And the two have been involved in a kind of ongoing turf war for quite a few years now. Right now, it doesn't control any territory, so it's not in some ways as powerful as it was back then. But what we have seen is that the areas of influence where ISK are carrying out attacks in Afghanistan spread to new parts of the country. So previously, they were concentrated in just the east. Now we've seen attacks in the north and the south. That's worrying a lot of people. And I think this derives from the fact that when the Taliban took over Afghanistan last summer, thousands of ISK prisoners who were held in jails escaped along with Taliban detainees as well. And that's kind of given a substantial manpower boost to ISK. We've also seen ISK launch on at least two occasions small rocket attacks across the border from northern Afghanistan into neighboring Tajikistan and Uzbekistan. And these were small attacks. They didn't cause significant damage, but it underlines the fact that ISK has global ambitions, even if it doesn't have a kind of a proper global capacity at the moment. It's very worrying for people in the region. We've also seen a rise in attacks by ISK in Pakistan as well. One of the reasons when you speak to the Taliban officials about some of their hardline policies is they, in private, admit to fears about ISK trying to woo away or recruit some of their fighters if they're seen as moderating their stance too much.
Is there a sense that, given what's been happening in Ukraine over the last few months, that Afghan people have been forgotten by the international community?
Yes, I think there certainly is a sense of that. And, you know, there was already a sense of abandonment in Afghanistan, particularly amongst many, many professionals last year after the kind of chaotic evacuation and those who didn't make it out felt like the international community were very much leaving them behind. And there were still large numbers of Afghans who want to leave the country, either because of the poor economic situation, now also many families worried about whether they'll be able to give their daughters an education, for example. On the face of it, at the moment, it doesn't seem like they will be anytime soon. So there was already a feeling of abandonment. That's been exacerbated, I think, by the kind of switch in media focus to the obviously also devastating conflict in Ukraine. And that is something that people feel. We've also seen it, I think, but perhaps in terms of engagement with the international community, diplomats are still going. They're still talking to the Taliban. But, you know, I speak to one Western official, for example, about a large humanitarian pledging conference that took place earlier this year. And he was saying the combination of events in Ukraine and the kind of real hardening of stance by the Taliban in terms of how they treat women, for example, how they deal with dissent, that would lead to a chilling effect on donors, because they would think at a time like this, when there's so much else going on in the world, is Afghanistan where we want to be concentrating our efforts? But of course, it's ordinary Afghan people who suffer the price for those decisions that are made by both the Taliban and the international community.
Ben Carter talking to Sukunda Kamani. Joining me now in the briefing room to analyse the current situation are the three experts who we always turn to when we're talking about Afghanistan. Laurel Miller is the director of the International Crisis Group's Asia programme. Ashley Jackson is co-director of the Centre for the Study of Armed Groups at the Global Affairs think tank, ODI. And Ahmed Rashid is a journalist and author based in Pakistan who has studied the Taliban for decades. Ahmed Rashid, there was a flattering hope 11 months ago amongst some people that the moderates or pragmatists in the Taliban would have more influence. That doesn't quite seem to have happened, does it?
No, not at all. In fact, I would say the extremists have consolidated their position. There is now, for certain, a big gap between the very extreme Taliban, religious-minded, who are in Kandahar, in the south of the country, and others more pragmatic, who are in Kabul. This mirrors exactly what happened the first time the Taliban were in government, when Kandahar was the bastion of reaction and unacceptance of any kind of moderate program. And Kabul had a government that was fairly moderate and was dealing with the UN, the Red Cross, and NGOs and all. But we're having exactly that same situation now.
Why does Kandahar win out over Kabul then?
Well, the leaders tend to stay in Kandahar. I mean, Mullah Omar, who was the original founder of the Taliban, never came to Kabul, or came once or twice for a couple of days, but never lived in Kabul. And that is being repeated by the current leader, Hebatullah Akhundzada, who also does not live in Kabul and is very mysterious, keeps himself very well covered. We don't even have a recent photograph of him as to what he looks like. And he certainly doesn't give any public speeches or addresses. He gives addresses, but very privately, which are published. So it's an anomaly of the Taliban, how they operate. And of course, that makes it much more difficult for the international community to collaborate with the Taliban.
Actually, for that very reason, Laurel, you might have anticipated that the more pragmatic Taliban would win out. So how would you explain their failure?
They are predominantly focused on their internal concerns, their concerns and priorities that come from within the Taliban movement and their domestic policies. And although they would also, at least the relatively more pragmatic ones, would also no doubt prefer to have positive relationships with countries in the international community and some level of continued assistance to Afghanistan, they're not going to compromise on their domestic priorities in order to achieve those things. It's just a fact that the international community, particularly the Western powers, have very limited influence over the situation in Afghanistan because the current authorities are, for the most part, immune to that influence. I mean, not 100% immune, but very strong antibodies to influence from the international community. That means that there are some tools that can be used to sort of chip away at the edges, but not really any levers to effectuate major shifts in Taliban policies.
But Ashley, how is the Taliban functioning internally as a government? I mean, as in ministers of agriculture, transport, business, etc., especially given that the leadership seems to be in Kandahar while the ministries presumably are still in Kabul. Is anything actually getting done?
It's not functioning terribly well, but it's functioning better than it was last time. A few months ago, the Taliban presented a budget. They just sort of updated that with another budget. It looks very unrealistic, but compared to last time around, they never had a functioning budget. I think, you know, you have a lot of technocrats who've stayed from the last government and ministries like the Ministry of Finance. I assume they're the ones writing the budget. You have others in the Ministry of Education. And you have a lot of people who were assuring Western donors that things like girls' education would be restored. You even had the deputy leader of the movement, Sarojini Nadkarni, assuring Western diplomats that those things would happen. So you have, at least in Kabul, you have the vestiges, the bureaucracy of government, but you don't have money, which is a huge problem. You have economic collapse, and you don't have a leadership that's in touch with the ground realities. It's a few mullahs isolated in Kandahar. So even though you do have the bureaucracy, there's nothing at the top to sort of drive things in any sort of coherent direction.
But as we know with government, if it's not tended, it crumbles.
Exactly. And I think we're beginning to see that. I think, you know, there are people who stuck around really hoping that, okay, we can be a moderate influence on the Taliban. We still have to serve our country. But they're not being listened to. They're not being listened to on substantive issues anymore. They're being shut down. They're being harassed in the streets by this vice and virtue ministry. I think, you know, friends have described it as slowly being suffocated. And it leaves ordinary Afghans very, very few options and people feeling increasingly hopeless.
Laurel, one aspect of that helplessness, which we were looking at almost the last time anybody was really thinking about Afghanistan over here, was because of the humanitarian crisis. Now, Secunda Kamani earlier told us that the Afghan people currently feel abandoned by the international community. Can we in the West object to that assessment?
The problem is, I mean, to say the West abandoned Afghanistan suggests that first of all, there was an obligation to continue the truly extraordinary levels of aid beyond the humanitarian sphere that was propping up the last government. I don't personally think that was the case. And it's also the reality that there are very limited policy options for Western governments in terms of engagement with the current regime there. I do think there's more that can be done. And so the engagement could, in principle, at least be stepped up beyond what it is now. But, you know, I think there are Afghans, understandably, who are in despair at the changes that have occurred in Afghanistan since the Taliban takeover and would have preferred for NATO and the United States to have stayed militarily in the country to prevent that change of government. And really, that's the only thing that might have, at least for a time, prevented the change of government that has led to the circumstances that we now see.
Ashley, when we last looked at this, one of the issues that kept on getting raised was the freezing of billions of dollars of Afghan money in foreign bank accounts. Now, is there any indication that those assets will be unfrozen?
Not particularly. You had a court case in the United States, the 9/11 families, or at least some of the 9/11 families, lobbying to get those assets. There's a decision to give those assets to them. It will be tied up in litigation and politics for quite some time. It's incredibly complex, but in the meantime, it means that you don't have a functioning central bank. You don't have an Afghan government who's able to access its reserves. And I don't see a lot of movement in a productive direction. To the question of whether or not the West has abandoned Afghanistan, I think it's even worse. I think they're punishing Afghanistan for what happens. And not just Afghanistan, they're punishing Afghans. The Taliban doesn't care. Laurel was absolutely right when she said there's very little influence the West has. And so the Afghan people bear the brunt of that decision. Those frozen assets, the cuts in aid, mean that 70% of families don't have enough to eat. 3 million children are malnourished or starving. They're bearing the brunt of these political and legal decisions.
Ahmed Rashid, in Pakistan, do you get a sense of exactly that, the humanitarian crisis, the scale of problems for people in Afghanistan?
Yes, you do, because the fact is that thousands of Afghans are living in Pakistan. Their extended families are coming here to join them as refugees, not perhaps registering as refugees as such, but smuggling themselves into Pakistan. And there's a huge economic crisis here with the government literally facing dire bankruptcy and trying to negotiate a deal with the IMF. And many people are comparing the situation in Pakistan to what happened in Sri Lanka a few weeks ago when the government defaulted on its debt. And so this region is really full of problems. So it's a really difficult problem, which has been made much worse by the very tense situation on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan. and the lack of, you know, collective action on the border so that smuggling of foodstuffs can stop and there can be a more sensible approach. Pakistan has provided a considerable aid to Afghanistan, but it's not enough for 30 million people.
Well, let's move on to Pakistan's relationship with the Taliban. How would you characterize that relationship as of now, Ahmed?
Well, you know, there was a kind of giddy response when the Taliban took over last August that, you know, oh, that's great. We've got our own puppet government in Kabul. And that was very quickly torn apart by the fact that the Taliban have not dealt with the major issue that is between Pakistan and Afghanistan, and that is the role of the Pakistani Taliban, who have been launching attacks into Pakistan from bases in Afghanistan. Now, this is something the Pakistanis were very anxious that the Taliban should put a stop to. But we've seen an escalation of these attacks in the last few months. Every day, almost, a Pakistani soldier is being killed on the border by Pakistani Taliban. And so there's a real sense of crisis in the relationship. There's a constant refrain from the Pakistan government that they're doing their utmost to have a ceasefire, to come to an understanding with the Afghan Taliban. And remember, I mean, what the Taliban had promised in Doha when they first made the agreement with the Americans, allowing the Americans to withdraw, they promised that they would never allow foreign terrorist groups on their soil. But that's exactly what they're doing. They're allowing Pakistani Taliban to take up residence in Afghanistan and use that as a base to attack Pakistan.
Right. Let's talk about some of the other neighbours of Afghanistan. Laurel, what do we know about the relationships between the Taliban and Iran?
Over recent years, Iran has hedged its bet with the last Afghan government by increasing its ties with the Taliban, increasing its ability to have a relationship with them if and when they came into power, as they have now done. But there's still plenty of room for tension between the two, given that Iran has concerns about the minority Shia community within Afghanistan and its precarious security situation. And Iran's interests are predominantly in security of the bordering areas and being able to continue to exert some influence there to kind of have a buffer against insecurity from Afghanistan spilling over into Iran. But they've gone along with, as other countries in the region have done, with essentially normalizing their relationship with the Taliban without giving a sort of stamp of official recognition, accepting Taliban representatives within the country, as Pakistan has done, as China has done, and some others. And I would expect to see them continue to try to maintain that relationship to be able to have some degree of influence in the country, but without really fully embracing the Taliban and kind of keeping a wary eye.
Ashley, again, when we looked at this last time, one country that people thought might seek to have some influence in Afghanistan and help the Taliban out a bit as a consequence was China. What has actually happened between the Taliban and China?
Not very much. I think, you know, China looks at its security interests and its economic interests in Afghanistan. They prefer stability and access to mineral resources, right? So they're perfectly willing to deal with the Taliban, to kind of bring them along so long as they benefit from the relationship. But for China to benefit from that relationship, a whole lot of infrastructure has to be built to access those mines. You need the Taliban to be somewhat functional in ways that it is not yet. So I think China is probably looking at Afghanistan with a bit of skepticism right now.
Can I ask you, Laurel, how the Biden administration has developed its attitude towards the Taliban?
I think politically, you have to say that, you know, the Biden administration would prefer to never hear the word Afghanistan again, if it could help it. I mean, and in a sort of political sense, not to say they won't continue humanitarian aid. You know, it was pretty notable in January that in the State of the Union address, the kind of signature speech of the president for the year, the word Afghanistan was not mentioned, even though he had delivered on his campaign promise to pull U.S. troops troops out of the country. And you might have considered that a success to celebrate when you keep a major campaign promise, but it wasn't. And I think Afghanistan is now a fairly politically toxic topic in Washington because of the nature, the controversies over the withdrawal and the chaos of the withdrawal.
Ahmed, you've talked about why it is that there hasn't been a Taliban 2.0 with the moderates having more influence. And I imagine from what you said, you don't see that as being likely to change.
Well, unfortunately, no, it's not likely to change in the immediate future. We had this shock decision to ban all girls from high school, to insist that women on TV should wear the full facial mask. I mean, amazing edicts that have come out just in the last couple of weeks, when the Taliban have already been under so much pressure from governments in the region and Western governments to change their attitude. And they really don't seem to care. I think one of the big problems is that, first of all, there's this rift between Kandahar and Kabul, Kandahar being the more conservative and determined to install what they believe are the Taliban laws of rule and how to govern, but also that the moderate figures in Kabul are some of the worst known terrorists who are wanted by the Americans and by Western agencies for acts of terrorism. Now, for example, I mean, the Haqqani brothers and the Haqqani group, which are famous for carrying out terrorist attacks against Westerners and against aid workers and others in previously during the war, are now known to be supporting girls' education and want changes done. Now, is there any way that the Americans are going to be able to engage with the Haqqanis to support their slightly more moderate tone? I doubt that very much. You have many internal problems with the Taliban that are really affecting their ability to actually communicate with the West.
Ashley, I'm going to ask you what may seem like an almost impossible question, but is it your impression that the UK and America, the West collectively, wants the Taliban to succeed or wants it to fail or simply believes it can't have an influence either way?
I think the problem is that the West itself doesn't know what it wants the Taliban to do. It keeps making really unrealistic demands that aren't compatible with its very limited influence right now. And I think you have a lot of the countries who intervene militarily, the UK and the US, kind of fumbling around, muddling through, providing humanitarian aid, but not doing anything to deal with the sanctions issues and the central bank, which is actually driving the humanitarian crisis. So they're basically throwing a Band-Aid at the country that they know won't have very much effect. They've almost forgotten about counterterrorism. And a lot of what's happened since August feels like history repeating itself, where they just want to bury their head in the sand. But the problem is, when you do that with regard to Afghanistan, it always comes back to haunt you.
Ashley Jackson with Laurel Miller and Ahmed Rashid. My thanks to them and to Secunda Kamani. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Ben Carter and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon. If you enjoyed it, you can find many others on BBC Sounds, including What Impact Will the Northern Ireland Election Have?, How Has the War in Ukraine Changed German Politics?, and Will the Rwanda Plan Work?
Hi, I'm Andy Oliver, and I'd like to tell you all about my Radio 4 series, One Dish. It's all about why you love that one dish, the one that you could eat over and over again without ever getting tired of it. Each week, a very special guest will bring their favourite food to my table and we'll be unpacking the history of it. And food psychologist Kimberly Wilson is on hand to talk us through the science bit. What food reminds you of your child? What's your favourite place to go for dinner? What do you have for Sunday lunch? What's your favourite dessert? Do you say plantain or plantain? What food would you take with you to a desert island? What's your favourite type of chili oil? What do you have for breakfast? What's the best pasta? What's the one thing you look for? So if you're the sort of person who's already planning what you're having for lunch while you're eating breakfast, then this podcast is going to be right up your street. That's One Dish with me, Andy Oliver. Listen now on BBC Sounds.